Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Bikes for Death podcast. As always, my name is Patrick, and I'm your host. And on today's episode, I am catching up with John Schilling, who is the current Arizona Trail Race race director. And we are going to be talking about all things Arizona Trail. First off, we're going to get to know John a little bit. He took over as the race director in 2019, and he made some almost immediate changes to the race routes. So we're going to be learning about those. We're going to be learning about the history of the Arizona Trail, as well as some tips, guidelines, and insights from John himself on how to approach the Arizona Trail race. So if you've ever been interested in riding the Arizona Trail, or if you're just interested in learning more about John and this amazing trail that makes up one of the routes in the Bikepacking Triple Crown, this episode is for you. And it's also for me, because on April 11th, I'm signing up to do what I'm loosely describing as an ITT. Some people call that an individual time trial. For me, it's more like an individual time tour. But after many years of dreaming of taking on the Arizona Trail 300, I'm finally ready to give it a go. And I'm inviting you to join me. So if you haven't heard, I am hosting an unofficial group start of either the AZT 300 or 800. This is in no way a sanctioned or organized event. It's much like the Arizona Trail Race itself. I'm going to be showing up and riding it, and I would love to have other people out in the field doing their own ride. So if you've been looking to take on the Arizona Trail, this might be the perfect opportunity for you. I have all of the details listed at bikesordeath.com under the event page. You can find a link to registration. Of course, it's free to join. The registration is just a way for me to know who's coming, and so we can all coordinate. We have a little Facebook group going where we can just coordinate, get together, share tips, tricks, and ideas and logistics as we get ready to take on the Arizona Trail. So this episode is for you, and it's also for me, so I can do a little bit of homework on the trail itself and pick the brain of the man that's currently at the helms of the AZT. I really enjoyed getting to know John. I got to meet him back in 2021 when Miles and I rode the Queen's Ransom route, and it was great to catch up with John. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did. But before we get to it, let's take a moment to thank the people that made today's episode possible, starting with our latest patrons. So first up, we'd like to thank Seth Gearing, Rob Lawrence, and Derek Bowers for signing up to be sustaining members of the Bikes for Death podcast. And speaking of Patreon, I just released a very new segment of the Bikes for Death podcast called Come Ride With Me. The Come Ride With Me series is exclusive to patrons. It's something I've been wanting to do for patrons for a while. I get a lot of support from the community, and I just wanted to find a way to give back, and this seemed like a good thing that I could do. So let me just take a quick minute to tell you what Come Ride With Me is. In many ways, it's exactly what it sounds like. I'm going to be miking myself up on rides and just talking to you off the cuff, raw, unedited, and uncensored audio from my rides. And right now, those episodes are going to be talking about my personal journey as I take on a few events at the beginning of the year. So first off, next week, I'm taking on the Mid-South 100 with my girlfriend, Natalie. And then 2 weeks after that, I'm doing Ozark Despair. And then 2 weeks after that, I'm doing the Arizona Trail 300. And so I am currently in training mode, and that series is going to follow me on some of my training rides. I'm going to be telling you where I'm at, how things are going, what my thoughts are going into each of those events, and probably recapping how each one of them went. And I'm also going to use that format to answer questions and topics that my patrons want to hear about. As the series goes on, it'll evolve to just talk about whatever's going on. So If you're interested in that, or if you'd just like to support the podcast, you can find out more over at patreon.com/bikesordeath. Now, today's episode is also brought to us by my friends over at Campfire Cycling. Campfire Cycling is Tucson's bikepacking outfitter. And if you're going to do the Arizona Trail, make sure to head through Tucson and check out Campfire Cycling. Whether you need a gas canister, some tire sealant, an emergency repair, or just some advice and encouragement from fellow AZT bikepackers, they are ready to support you. And if you don't believe me, just ask Triple Crown winner and Arizona Trail Race record holder, Katia Rachmatulina, who did a last minute fork swap the morning she was headed out to the start of the Arizona Trail. And speaking of Katia, if you haven't listened to my episode with her, I highly recommend it. But Campfire Cycling has a full selection of bikepacking bikes from Surly, Salsa, Kona, and Bomb Track, and a massive collection of bags and racks by Revelate, Ovea Negra, Swift, Ortlieb, Arkle, Old Man Mountain, Tumbleweed, Tubus, and more. And while stopping in and talking to their team of dedicated bikepackers is the best way to go, they've also got a full-service e-commerce site selling all of these great products. And while you're there, check out their Make It Mine bicycle configurator, where you can upgrade and accessorize your bikepacking rig and get some built-in savings, which is pretty freaking cool. Campfire Cycling hosts 7 bikepacking trips a year, from beginner to advanced level trips around southern Arizona. Riding with Campfire is a perfect way to prep for your AZT adventure. So, to check out Campfire Cycling, you can find them online at campfirecycling.com or on Instagram at Campfire Cycling. So be sure to check them out for all your Arizona trail race needs. All right, ching, 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 the bills have been paid, and now it is time to get to my episode with John Schilling. One quick note about this episode, there is a little bit of feedback. I'm not sure what happened in some of the audio, but it's very much listenable. Just wanted to apologize for the feedback, a little bit of technical difficulties, but much like in bikepacking, we will put our heads down and carry on. But before we get to today's episode, let's have my friend Miles Arbor kick it off with the Bikes for Death theme song.
You load up your bike, you ride away from home. You could be with your friends or you could be alone. You ride for a day or maybe more. You just love being in the great outdoors. Everything you need is strapped to your bars, including that new pillow you got from Santa Claus. And then you think, oh shit, to yourself. You left that super lightweight tent on the living room shelf. Bikes for death. Bikes for death. Podcast.
I figured I'd give you a minute to, before we jump into like AZT stuff, do you want to pitch the Queen's Ransom and what that is? That's another thing that you do there in Arizona.
Yeah. Sure.
So what, and I've ridden part of that route, so I'm familiar with it.
Yeah,
it's great.
It's it just started. It didn't even like start as anything. It wasn't supposed to be anything. It was for me, and it was just a kind of a challenge that me and a couple of my friends had back when, well, now it's been 11-12 years. We were just kind of into making big routes like from our house, and Phoenix is kind of blessed with a whole bunch of trail systems all around. So we're like, well, can we do like, the original goal was, could you do 100-mile mostly single track or at least dirt route, like from your front door? And I was able to do that, which is essentially the first day of the Queen's Ransom now, but then you kind of loop back on some roads and it's like 102 miles. And then I started to look at the map and I was like, well, man, the AZTs is like right there. And it's like my favorite section of the Arizona Trail, the picket post to Kelvin. And I was like, yeah, I wonder if I could make a loop out of that and make a bikepacking loop from my house. So I started kind of piecing it together. And it took like really like 2 years back then to really kind of figure it all out. Like the trail system stuff was pretty easy because I knew all that tied together and that went pretty well. But then there were these really two areas kind of linking the trails at Gold Canyon over to the picket post trailhead. And back then, online maps weren't quite as readily available. So you were still looking at topo maps and things like that. And in that area, there's a lot of jeep roads, which is great, but so many of them just dead end. And you're looking at the maps and you're just like, oh great, I can go this way. Like, oh no, dead end. So then I'd go out riding it and I found like a way through, but it was like kind of this crappy power line road, but I was like, yeah, it works. It's off the highway, whatever. And then one day I had my wife just drive me down to Florence, which is about 45 minute drive from here. And I just said, just drop me off. I'll find a way home. And I had about 10 dead ends that day, but I got it to work and I was like, okay, I think that'll do it. And then finally that was like the route. And the next year I tried it out. I ended up DNFing the first year on day two because I tried a new saddle for a bike bagging ride. Just don't ever do that. Yeah. that was just bad. And it was like middle of April. Cause I'm thinking, well, the AZT's run in April. I'll do mine like a week before it, you know, it should be fine. Well, of course it was like 98 degrees and I'm like, yeah, nah, not for a fun ride. I'm not doing that. So I just bailed that first year. But then the second year, I had one other guy join me from Tucson who I didn't even know. I don't even know how he found out about it because I didn't publish it like anywhere. I don't even remember telling anybody about it. So anyway, he like comes up to ride it and we did it in March and we ended up doing that first year in 3 days and we finished it. And I remember telling him, I was like, well, I think that should be a 4 day route, you know, because it was like just these 380 plus mile days and it was just really, really hard. So that's kind of how it started. And then just each year, it seemed like more and more people just kind of heard about it. And it went from like two people to three to five, you know, and just like that. And then the next thing I knew, I think in 2016, I had like a group of 10 or 12 kind of join in. Mm-hmm. That was really the first year that it was like, you know what, this thing's kind of catching on and people are digging it. And I took out some of that really silly hard stuff that I had in there just because I put it in because I like it, you know. But then I was like, you know, it's probably really not smart to take bikepacking rigs down like a double black, you know, technical trail. I was like, nah, maybe not. And then, so just, you know, little tweaks like that. And then you have like some property issues creep up where you have to come up with reroutes, like any route, you know, you just got to be on top of it. And that's just kind of how it went. And then next thing I know, you and Miles are coming out riding it. And about that time, it was like, I had been considering publishing it. And then when you wrote it and was like, oh, we should do it. And I was like, yeah, you know, I think it's time. And then just kind of, as they say, the rest is history. And that was 3 years ago already?
I think it was 2020, December of 2021, I believe.
That sounds about right. Yeah, I think that's right. So yeah.
I was trying to remember too, because we met up for a quick beer whenever Miles and I were in town. That's the first time and only time we met until today. But I was like going back in my memory bank and I'm like, I think it was December 2021.
Yeah.
And the weather was fantastic for the most part. It was wonderful. So and the route's great too. Yeah.
And then now I've settled on like essentially the first weekend in March is like the sweet spot. And I just kind of scheduled it really 2 weeks after the 24-hour in the Old Pueblo in case anybody racing that wants like a week off and still wants to do this, they have the opportunity. But as you've kind of heard now, it's become quite popular. So now I have to like cap the ride because I don't want it to be like this total free for all. So I sort of cap it at 30. And this year, I think I had 26 people sign up in the first 4 minutes. And it was like, geez, it's crazy. But, you know, whatever. I've got people coming in from Maine, Florida, you know, Washington, 3 people from Canada this year, like Illinois, Oklahoma. I mean, like all over the place. So it's pretty cool.
You know, that I relate to that through my East Texas Showdown. Like I kind of created that for me as like the kind of ride that I would want to do. And I created it also kind of for Texas. So Texas has some bikepacking options here in our home state. And then everybody from, I mean, internationally comes and you're like, holy crap. You know, I really wasn't expecting that.
It's pretty so wild. Cool. It's quite humbling, actually. I had a guy fly over last year from Switzerland. And I was like, was this like the only reason you came over here? I was like, Rick, really? And he's like, well, no, I was planning this big Southwest trip, you know, and I was looking for routes to do. And he did the Fool's Loop. And then the very next day he came and did the Queen's Ransom. And then he ended up riding like all the way up to Flagstaff and then on the Moab and all this stuff. And I was like, well, fantastic. But he had a good time on the Queen's Ransom. He ended up coming back for the AZT 800 in October as well. So I was like, oh, that's cool. So
is that guy, was he on a fat bike?
That was Thomas Dursen. He was riding.
Guy.
Yeah, it wasn't a full fat bike, but it was he had a different frame bag. It was kind of almost like a homemade kind of thing, but definitely different looking. And yeah, it was an interesting setup, but yeah, he's obviously a really strong rider and he pulled it off. So
that's so interesting. I had a very similar experience. I had a guy come, I think from Europe, UK, flew over here, did the East Texas Showdown. And then directly after leaving here, he got over. He was trying to do it all human powered or go by bus and train and not use vehicles and stuff. And so I don't remember exactly how he got over there, but he got over to Arizona and then rode all of the, I think he did the AZT 300 and just stayed in the area. So there was another guy who came down and kind of sandwiched in a bunch of stuff at the same time. So you're right. It's very humbling and it's exciting that, you know, the word gets out there. You just kind of throw it out there and people find out about it and then they want in.
Yeah. Well, I was out just on a regular Saturday ride or something. And I was over on part of the route, but just unintentionally. And I see two bike packers coming towards me. So I stop and I'm like, hey, so I chat with them and I'm like, oh, what route are you doing? And they're like, oh, the Queen's Ransom. And I said, oh, that's cool. I was like, well, that's my route. And then like, and they're like, oh, really? And I'm like, yeah, where are you from? And they're like, oh, we flew down from Alaska. And I was like, oh, well, awesome. And they're like, well, what should we know? And I'm like, well, we'll just keep riding. Just don't stop and make sure you finish it. So they're like, yeah. But it's like, you know, people don't tell me when they're doing it, which they don't have to. Right. It's a public route now. But it's funny hearing from friends, they'll be riding at Hawes and be like, hey, we saw some people bikepacking. They're doing the Queen's Ransom. And I'm like, oh, okay. It's like, cause everybody just assumes that I know. And I'm like, no, they don't have to tell me. I mean, it's like, whatever, but sometimes they do. And it's like, that's cool. Yeah, whatever.
So. Yep. I have some published routes too. And when I go ride my own routes, the exact same thing will happen. Yeah. I'm like, you know, I'll run into people and just get to chatting. And I'm like, yeah, I created the route. But most of the time they don't tell you. I mean, it's just, but that's the nice thing is it's just out there.
Right.
Anybody can ride it. And if you put together a good route and good information, then they don't need to bother you. Not that it's a bother, but you know, it's like they can just go do it.
That is kind of the end goal, right? It's sort of autopilot, you know, which is nice. Cause I mean, that's how I do routes too. It's like, I don't want to be bugging all the route owners every time I want to go do a ride. Right. It's like, nope, here's the info. I just need a track. Is there water? Yep. Can I buy food? Sure. All right. I'm good, man.
I mean, it's a vetted route. So, you know, and it's like you said, you know, so much of route creation is just testing all the dead ends, right? I mean, it looks one way on satellite or ride with GPS or whatever. And then you get out there, it's just dead end after dead end. And so a big part of a route is, I mean, obviously resupply, like you said, but just a through route that, you know, just goes and someone's vetted it, you know?
Yeah. There's a weird spot, even on the Queen's Ransom, it's on the last day. And there's a big open area of Arizona State Trust land, which we're allowed to be on. You can buy a recreation permit and go on it. However, every so often they have chunks of state trust land that are completely fenced off and they just don't want you in it, even though it's like really no different than any other state trust land. So on the Queen's Ransom, the first year I was able to access it. And then the next year they closed off the one gate. So I was like, well, okay, well now what? You know, so I was like, well, this is like an 8 foot high fence. I'm not climbing over that. So now I found a way around it, but it's like, oh, okay. Just stuff to know, you know, it's just because it says state trust on a map doesn't mean that it's 100% guaranteed that you have access to it. But like you said, you have to, which you should, you know, put tires to the ground and go physically vet it all out just so you know. It's just a good practice, I think.
And they change all the time. So staying on top of it is a huge problem or obstacle that's just like ever evolving. I know like a local route that my friend Maxwell Johnson put out locally in Texas, the Texas barbecue route. just 2 days ago, someone posted on Facebook and said, hey, this historic bridge is out. Like, and so, you know, it's a reroute, but that's just part of the fun of route creation and all that. But again, you throw it on the internet and people can just go ride it. So,
And luckily people do give you the feedback that, you know, stuff like that you do need to know, which is great and much welcome. And I always appreciate all that. It's like, oh
yeah,
man, I was just out there 2 days ago and it was fine. You know, I was like, man,
cause you can't be out there all the time. So having eyes and ears in the field is great.
Yep.
Well, let's kick off our AZT conversation.
Yeah.
And I figure a good entry point into talking about AZT is I'd love to get like your own personal history. I think you were one of the first people to sign up for one of the first or really close to the...
it might seem or feel that way, but no.
I read on your blog, I thought you were, I thought you did like the 2012 or 2013, which was around the first... But you can give us your history with it. Yeah.
So with the 300, I believe, and sorry, Scott Morris, if I messed this up, but this is just off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure the first 300, I think was 2006. I think he scouted it in 05. But you are correct. 2012 was the first one that I tried. I thought about doing it in 11 because I was like just getting into bike packing then, kind of gathering all my gear. And in hindsight, I'm really glad I didn't do 2011 because the AZT wasn't officially completed down by the Gila River. That was the last official segment built. So they still had to go the old route, which is pretty gnarly. And then 2011 happened to be a really, really hot year. So I was kind of glad I didn't go that year. I think only four people finished it. And, I believe Linda Wallenfels won it that year. And then I finally gathered enough gear and I was like, all right, 2012 is the year, but I still had never even bike packed. So me and my buddy, 2 weeks before the race, we went out to the Ripsey segment and we did an overnight, like a 55-mile lollipop on the AZT through Ripsey, camping right next to our truck. And we're like, well, I'll just pretend the truck's not there. We got all our gear and everything. And he's like, yeah, but I have beer in the truck. I was like, all right, we'll get the beer. Then pretend it's not there. And then, so we did that. And then like 2 weeks later, I show up at the 300 for my first go at it. Didn't even own a tent, didn't own a bivy. I took a tarp because I was like, well, it's something, right? In case it rains. And of course, on day two, they're predicting a storm, 30% chance of showers. I was like, yeah, big deal, right? So, you know, and I get into the second day, you wake up and I camped at Kentucky camp that race. And that morning, it's like 30 mile an hour crosswinds coming out of Kentucky camp. It's like 38 degrees. It's cold rain. It turns to sleet, turns to snow, back to sleet in the death mud. I mean, just garbage. I mean, just a horrible day coming in the Tucson and just bike is caked up with mud. So you spent like the whole day just fighting all that stuff. And I didn't know what the heck to do. And then we had heard reports that like Kirk, I think he was leading the race that year. He was the only rider that beat the road closure going up Mount Lemmon because they got so much snow up top. They shut it all down. Yeah. He ended up, I think, walking the whole top of that road because his drivetrain froze solid or something like that. And everybody else had to like sleep in the market at the bottom until they reopened the thing, reopened the road. So me and another guy I was riding with, we ended up just getting a hotel in Tucson and I didn't have any winter gear, nothing, just so unprepared for those kind of conditions. And we just ended up DNFing it that year in Tucson. But, you know, it kind of lit the fire. And looking back, it's like, man, I really learned like, well, hey, I should probably, you know, have a bivy or at least something to just get out of the weather if it's really, really bad. And then you just kind of stew on it for 365 days or until the next go around. But in the meantime, I think I did the Coconino 250 that following October and did finish it. And so I was like, okay, I can do a big bike packing effort. And so I felt good going into 2013, but it was one of those things is like, I'm finishing this no matter what. I don't care how long it takes. I'm getting it done. And I did, I stuck with it. I thought I could get in under 4 days, but man, I thought I was going to die in the Gila Canyons that year, but I got in at like 4:02 or something like that. And I was pretty happy with that. But you know, it's one of those rides. It's, you know, and they say it all the time, how like it changes you. It, you know, was it life changing? I don't know. I mean, it was definitely a bike changing moment for me. Cause I knew at that point, like, man, I can do any ride that I really put my mind to. And that's what it was for me. And I didn't initially like just assume like, oh, I'm going to go do the full thing right away. I was like, I didn't quite know I was like ready for something like that. But you know, you start looking at maps a whole different way and just knowing that you can just cover these big miles now. And I was like, oh, okay. Maybe I can do a little bit more than I thought previously, which I think you always can, you know, people just don't know until they try. Right.
Oh yeah. For sure.
They have this preconceived notion like, oh, I can only ride, you know, pick a number, right? 40 miles. I've never done a 45, but, you know, and then they go out and do it and like, oh, well, I didn't die. You know, it's like, I might have wanted to, but you know, hey, I did a 46 mile ride today. Well, great. Well, maybe next time try 50. And that's, it's just, you just keep stacking it, you know, and then it gets to a point where it's just wash, rinse, repeat, right? And that's it.
Yeah,
do I have water? Do I have food? Am I healthy? Is my bike running? Yeah, then why stop, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like my progression and most people's progression is just like, okay, you do 20, you know, you remember when like 20 feels like a long way. You remember when 100 feels like a long way. But once you get to a certain level, like, you know, for example, like once you complete the AZT 300, not to say you could just do anything willy-nilly, but like you get to a point where like you're like, okay, I'm capable of doing quite a bit. Obviously, you got to train and be prepared and everything. Right. But it just, at some point, you're just like, okay, I can do a lot of this.
Right. Because it's like, to me, it was, you know, going into that ride, obviously, I'm like, because I tell people, I was like, man, 2 years before even trying that, if you would have told me that I was going to line up for a 300 mile, essentially nonstop bike ride, I would have like, you're crazy, right? I mean, I've never even ridden 25 miles. Like, what are you talking about? How do you even do that? You know, but then, you know, even before the ride though, but once you're into it, right, and you're studying and you're planning and you're training, all that stuff, that's what's so cool to me. It's just like, and that's where you can really figure out like, well, yeah, I can do these bigger rides because I know how to prepare for it. Right. Mm-hmm. Maybe I don't know how to prepare for the Tour Divide fully, but it's the same thing. It's just longer, right? You know, it's still riding your bike, you know, and going to convenience stores and sleeping on the side of a road, you know, I mean, it's just a lot more days. Right. And, you know, it can be a little overwhelming with the amount of data you have to sift through for something like that, but you just got to sit down and do it. Right. It's the process is the same.
You know? Yeah. And I love the process, and hopefully this podcast is just, you know, I don't think a podcast can like be the full homework for somebody, but like, just an introduction, a starting point with AZT but you're right. Like once you have like the systems in place of like, okay, I need camping gear, I need food, I need water. You know, you develop all the tools, the challenges are going to change. The terrain's going to change the distance, the weather, like there's always variables, but wash, rinse, repeat, like you said.
And even talking about it with you today, it's like I wouldn't want this to be like, oh, all you have to do is just go watch, listen to that podcast and you'll know what to do, or you'll have like your cue sheet done. That's not what this is. It's like I want you to study the route, and like I don't, like maybe I'll tell you where like there's one tricky water source, but I'm not going to tell you where they all are. I mean, do some homework, you know, because doing that homework, when you actually get out there, you're going to be like, oh yeah, this is what the one I read about. It's right here, exactly where I thought it was going to be, or exactly where, you know, somebody's blog told me it was going to be, and how to access it. And then you feel like you just feel more empowered that way. And like, because as you know, no matter all the homework you do, there's always going to be a surprise, right? Always. It's like you can count on that, because nothing ever goes to plan, right? I mean, if it does, it's like, wow, that was weird, you know. So and those are ones like, how was the ride?
I think it
was great, you know. It was sunny, it was beautiful, no wind, perfect.
So it's like, never. Adventure starts when things go wrong, and things always go wrong or sideways, but it's still good to prepare. And I agree, like, you know, with my own routes, I always tell people, like, it's solo self-supported. It is your job and your responsibility to know where you're going. If you're worried about a resupply point, you know, call ahead, verify it, do whatever you need to do, but it's on you to vet the route and to find all that stuff. But hopefully we can kind of give some people an introduction and a good place to start,
at least to where, like, start looking here. Right,
start looking here. I'll point you in the right direction.
For sure. And there's plenty of places, great places to get that info that you do need, that are very helpful. So
I mean, just so you know, and also for the listening audience, I thought we'll chat today, and then like at the end of today's episode, I actually want you to point us to, you know, other resources, just like point people in the right direction. So we'll definitely like hit on that.
I actually wrote some down.
Perfect. You did your homework.
How about that? A little bit.
Actually,
anyway.
You did bonus work because I didn't give you any homework. So you're just like Johnny on the spot over there. Look at you. I like it.
Well, it's only because, and it's funny because I even tell my wife, it's like, well, I better write the stuff down because like my email, the website, the AZT website is like, they're all very similar, but they're just different enough. You know? So I'm like, and they're
keeping
it's
all
just
true.
Like that. I don't know. There's like reasons and stuff, but not intentional or anything, but you know.
So, I'd like to start with like to your, I mean, I don't know how much of the history of the AZT, as it relates to bike packing, maybe not like the entire Arizona trail, but like, I'd love to just capture some of the history, you know, who started it when. I actually thought it started in 2012 because that's the first time it showed up on Track Leaders, but Scott Morris is the one who created Track Leaders. Yeah. I'm guessing he didn't do that till later. And so I just learned from you that it actually started earlier than that. So
I want to say I followed it on Track Leaders, I think in 2009. I think that was the first year I followed or heard about it.
Okay.
So that's when I kind of got in the whole Track Leaders and like, oh, what are these dots and all that kind of stuff and figuring that out. And that's, you know, as you know, that hooks you right there. And it was like, oh, they do this every year in April. All right, cool. I'll follow next year or whatever. So, but you know, and back then a lot of the info was out on like, you know, on forums and things like that. So people would do race updates on that. And it was kind of cool. You got to actually meet maybe some of the more behind the scenes of each rider on the forums, unlike, so, you know, it's just different today. You know, it's, most of the stuff seems to be on Facebook, and I try to promote people to call in the MTB cast number because that's just fantastic. Because it's just, you get everything just live as you can when people are out in the throes and thick of it, which is pretty cool. But as far as the history, I think I want to say there was a book by Andrea Langford, and I think she's kind of credited as one of the first people to actually through ride the AZT. And that was like, Scott used her book as his guide when he first toured it. And I want to say her book was like 2004 and Scott did the full tour in 05, following her route, which was, you know, trying to follow the AZT as best it could back then, because this was, you know, 04, 05. So that was, AZT wasn't officially completed until 2011. So a lot of it was, you know, missing and whatnot. So it's just, it was what it was, right? Because the 750 didn't start, the first year of that was 2010. So the 300 started a few years before the 750. Mm-hmm. And the first year of the 750, there was only one rider. I think it was Max Morris. He was the only one that did it. And then there was like maybe two in 2011 or something like that. It was kind of slow going at first because it, you know, and it wasn't really publicized. You know, it was like you either kind of knew about it or you didn't. And then word of mouth, and then took a few years. And it was probably, because I know 2012 when I showed up, which is kind of funny thinking back, because that when it started at Parker Canyon Lake that year. And I think there were six of us that camped out at the start that year. And then I think for the ride, there might've been 40 of us or so. It was a pretty good group. And then 2013, I remember there was quite a bit more at the start to camp out and maybe a little bit more for the ride, maybe like 50 or so. And then when I came back in 2016, I did the 750. And then that year it was pretty much a big deal full on at that point. But it just got, like I say, it kind of got going, I would think, in 05 would be my best guess on that one. So,
Scott Morris was the second person to do it potentially. So, so there's the Arizona Trail.
Yeah.
And then what they did is like adapted the Arizona Trail simply to navigate around the wilderness areas.
Well, the actual trail goes through wilderness. Now, the bike route obviously goes around. Yeah. So So they just do that just like the Colorado Trail does. And it was just, that's where Scott came in using, because like he tried to add in as much, you know, nearby single track as possible too, to keep it more in line with the AZT and not just have road detours around all the wilderness where possible. And And again, you know, we're kind of blessed, like just like really where the trail runs, it runs right up the middle of the state more or less. And if you actually look like on trail forks and you look at Arizona as a whole and you see where all the trails are, well, they just, all the trails happen to be right in the middle of the state too. So it just sort of works out that when you're off the AZT, a lot of times you do have single track options, which is really cool. So you're not just riding dirt roads or even pavement, you know, to get around these wilderness areas. You're still kind of sticking with the theme of the AZT, even when you're not on it, which is really nice. And yeah, we've even heard some feedback and it was almost a complaint. They're like, man, the full AZT, there's like too much single track. And I'm like, what? That's the point. Like, I wish there was 800 miles of it, but which, yeah, someday there might be. That's the AZTA's goal. So,
yeah. Oh, is to make it all single track.
The full Arizona Trail, the Arizona Trail Association's goal, yes, is to have 800 miles of single track from border to border.
And, oh, wow.
And we joke about that. We're like, all right, well, when you're done with that, are you going to then try to make the bike detours also 100% single track? Are you going to pitch in the help with that too? And, I mean, who knows, maybe.
How is the relationship between, you know, the Arizona Trail Race and the Arizona Trail Association? I know, you know, sometimes we hear about conflict between trail users and, you know, and that can become right. A hot topic. And obviously you want to keep on the good terms of ATA.
Oh, absolutely. No, so, that's a great question. It's,
yeah,
the, I guess the disclaimer is the Arizona Trail Association is not affiliated in any way, shape or form with the Arizona Trail Race. However, they, you know, quotes, support it. I mean, they know about it. Every once in a while, even at the start, we'll have members of the ATA actually come to the start to say a couple of words to the riders and just let them know just how awesome the Arizona Trail is and to remind them, you know, hey, make a donation to the trail because you are riding it, you know, which is great. And donations help add rollover gates, which if you've been on the Arizona Trail, you know, there's like, I don't know, maybe like 200 gates that you have to open and close along the trail. So anytime we can replace one of those barbed wire ranch gates with a rollover gate, that's a pretty awesome feeling. So yeah, and the ATA, I think they pride themselves in the fact that they are very a bike friendly national scenic trail, unlike some of the other ones that are 100% no bikes, you know, and some of them you just wouldn't want to take a bike on anyway. But it's really cool that they're 100% in favor of bike travel on the AZT outside of wilderness, you know. So it's, they promote bike access, hike access, horse access, and just have at it.
That's wonderful. Yeah,
it's awesome. And I have a very good working relationship personally with them. I'm friends with a handful of people that work there. So I do get pretty quick updates when they do the reroutes, even the small projects that they might not even publish, because it was like, ah, it's just a quick little half mile, you know, drainage reroute. But it's like, hey, just a heads up, we did a little work effort here. You don't have to go down in that drainage. You can just go around it now. It's like, oh, cool. I'll get the track and update it and the file for everybody. And it's pretty cool. And so, yeah.
That's fantastic to hear.
It is.
So with that in mind, does the ATA kind of, when they're building, you know, you're saying that they're trying to build the entire thing to be 800 miles of single track, do right. they build the single track with all trail users in mind, including mountain bikers or cyclists?
I would say yes, especially the in later years. And excuse me. And this goes for obviously outside of the wilderness areas. Inside wilderness areas, obviously they don't, you know, care about bikes because bikes aren't there. But yeah, I mean, it's they try to make it as rideable as a grade as possible as the terrain allows. And I mean, you've been to Arizona, you know, that's not an easy task. And I think anybody that, you know, if you ride enough miles and do these big rides, and it's like, and I'm kind of known for it, but I mean, I would like to think that every once in a while, even the staunchest of person that's against hike a bike actually enjoys it for at least for a little bit, just to get off. Like, all right, we've been riding for hours. All right, so we have to get off and walk for 2 minutes. All right, cool. You know, whatever. You know, use some other leg muscles, right? Take a snack, take a photo, enjoy the scenery, and then, you know, hike up a couple switchbacks and then start riding again. But yeah, I mean, they do try to make it as rideable as possible, and yeah, like they're one of the recent big projects that they just pretty much, I think they've now wrapped it up, is the AZT portion of the Highline Trail. And that's up in Rim Country near the town of Pine. So the Highline Trail is a 50-mile scenic trail that runs from Pine towards just heading east along the base of the Mogollon Rim. Well, the AZT overlaps it for 19 miles before it peels off the Highline and goes straight up the rim. But the early years of the AZT, the 750, that was one of the most loathed sections of trail because it was like essentially 18 miles of hike a bike. I mean, it was horrible. Just rutted. It was an old, I don't even remember what it was. I think it was an old military route or something, just that was built like in the late 1800s or something for supply. So it was just up, down, rutted, you know, with the monsoon storms. It was just horrible. It wasn't really even a great hiking trail. So anyway, they took on this project, the Tano National Forest in the area, the ATA, and it was a volunteer organization for Arizona over the years, set out to rehabilitate the entire 50 miles of the trail. And of course, they started with the part that wasn't the AZT. And they built that really nice. And I was like, oh man, I wish they would do that to the AZT. Well, they finally did and finished it up last year. And if you hear any of the riders' reports from this past year, they just raved about that section. Now it's actually a destination-worthy trail for Phoenicians in the summer. You know, when it starts to get hot, go up the rim country, you go do a loop on the Highline Trail. It's fantastic. And there's like almost zero hike a bike on it. Like it's hard to believe. Anybody, I tell people that have raced the Arizona trail race, say more than 5 years ago, they still have nightmares of that trail. It's just like, no, it's you wouldn't even recognize it. It just, it's just this beautiful single track now.
They have PTSD.
Yeah. I mean, seriously. And it's just like, no, that's not true. It's like, no, look, here's video. Here's like legit proof. Go ride it, man.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's cool to see.
So you became race director in 2019, is that correct?
Correct. Yeah.
And you made some changes to the route, I think almost that first year. Is that, I mean, does that kind of speak to what you're talking about now? Just like the ATA, the Arizona Trail is evolving quite a bit. And so you just took advantage of some of the new routes or what? Or new trails?
So 2019 was an interesting year because so that year my personal calendar, I was like training for the Tour Divide. That was my year to knock out the third of the big three. And Scott reached out to me, I think it was early in the spring or even late winter, asking me if I wanted to take it over. And in 2019, we were still running it in April. And I was like, well, let me think about it. And then I kind of got back to him. I was like, well, I'd kind of like to do it. However, I'm kind of like preoccupied with this personal goal of mine. So in 2019, we more or less went in 50-50 on it. So I was like, well, I'll help out, I'll do some of the parts. And then, you know, if you can help answer questions or whatever he needed to do. And so it just worked out really good that way. In the meantime, and I think this was right after the Grand Depart, so maybe in May or something like that, kind of when it was winding down, I believe we were reached by the ATA with a kind of just a question asking if Scott had ever considered moving the Grand Depart to the fall. And Scott was like, well, yeah, I had thought about it, but never really seriously. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. It never really crossed my mind either. We just had always done it in the spring. And so I was like, well, why don't we just ask people, see what people want. So I put a poll up. I put it on the, back then people were still kind of going to the forum. So I put one on the forum. I put one on the Facebook group just to get feedback. And we actually got a fair amount of feedback. And I was pretty blown away by it. And I think Scott was too, because it was like 95% of the respondents wanted an October start.
Wow.
And we were like, wow. Like, I didn't see that coming. I thought it was going to be maybe split or maybe slightly skewed one way or the other, but not like almost unanimous. Right. And it seemed like the prevailing argument was like for all the non-Arizonans, because they're like, oh, in April, we're snowed in the wintertime. We can't train for it. We get down there and it's already warm and we're just getting our butt kicked. And I was like, oh, yeah, all right. So and I was like, well, it's a lot less daylight in October, but, I was like, all right, well, it's like anything. There's pluses and there's minuses. So we're like, well, let's give it a shot and we'll see how it goes. And so that was like the first change. And then, of course, COVID in 2020 happened. So then the race was canceled. So I was like, well, since it's canceled, why don't we? And then I'm just like, well, I think I'm just going to start really looking at the entire route And that would be a good time. If we're going to make any other changes, let's just all in. Right. So, and Scott had always had this mindset of like, you know, we don't just, and this people always laugh because it's like, what about Oracle Ridge? Because he's like, yeah, people, I always get hate mail. He's like, why are we doing that trail? It's horrible. And he's like, well, but it's the Arizona Trail. And, you know, it is what it is. You know, you just kind of get through it. And there was other sections of the route where it was just even more difficult than Oracle Ridge. So it was like, he never wanted to just add AZT just for the sake of adding AZT. If it was just so just ridiculously difficult when there wasn't even a sort of a better option. Right. Okay. So one of those areas was up near Four Peaks, this Boulder Creek area into Sunflower. And then it just had, because people just don't ride that as a day ride. It's stuck. It's sandwiched in between two wilderness areas. It's hard to get to. It's just the only people that ever go on are like through hikers. And I had ridden it a couple times, I guess, in the years leading up to 2019. And it wasn't that bad. It had gotten some work. There were some reroutes had been done. So I was telling Scott that, and he's like, oh, interesting. And I was like, well, maybe we can come up with a better way to get to it that makes more sense. You know, maybe like cut the route out through the Goldfield Mountains and use dirt going up Four Peaks on the front side instead of trying to come around from the backside. So I start, you know, we start looking at routes that way. And then, and when you know it, they kept doing more work on the Sunflower part. So then one day I was like telling Scott, I was like, you know what? It's really not that bad. It's pretty much in line with the rest of the route. I think we should just add it. And that was one of the big changes. So we put it in as an option in 2019, and we had two guys do it. And Justin Dubois was the first. He got through it first, and he just smoked it on single speed too. It was amazing to watch that guy do that route. So that was pretty eye-opening. And then I was like, all right, well, if we're going to make that change, you know, let's really dig into it. And I start looking at all the pavement options. And when you know it, there was like really good dirt options to get rid of a lot of the pavement. Yeah. And one of the bonuses, and one of the other major reasons to moving it to October, aside from the poll answer, is the Grand Canyon. And we had been getting a little bit of pushback from the Park Service on the North Rim side of it. So like riders, you know, they would do the portage following all the rules, and everything was cool. They'd get to the North Rim. And in April, for probably 98% of the riders, they'd have the trail was buried in snow. That's just how it is up there. It's 9,000 feet. They get a lot of snow. The North Rim's closed to the public pretty much from October 15th to April 15th every year because of that. They don't plow it. It's only visited by maybe 10% of the visitors of the Grand Canyon. So what we would have the racers do, myself included, in 2016, we would just ride the paved road out of the park. And you'd hop over the closed gate and you just take the road down to Jacob Lake. And at Jacob Lake, you could get back on the trail because by then you've dropped like maybe almost 2,000 feet. So by then, usually the snow is gone. You pick up the trail for the last 29 miles to state line. But in October, the trail's going to be clear. That the first snows don't usually hit until somewhere around Thanksgiving, give or take. I mean, you might get one early one, but it's not going to stick. Yeah. So I was like, well, it is the Arizona Trail Race, right? And the goal is to not ride pavement, is to ride the AZT. And it's like, and the trail on the North Rim is some of the best in the state. And I was always kind of just bummed that riders were not getting that experience. And the Park Service kept pushing back, like, you know, you guys, you're not allowed to be on this closed road. It's too dangerous. And we're like, really? It's a closed road. How dangerous is it going to be? I'm like, do you realize who you're talking to? Like these guys just rode 700 miles to get here and then walk their bike through the Grand Canyon with their bike on their back, but yet they can't ride a closed road for 12 miles. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So instead you want them to go in the backcountry on a snow covered single track. All right. Gotcha. You know, like, all right. So anyway, it was just this really weird thing. And I believe it was 2019, they actually had a park ranger waiting for riders at the North Rim trailhead for like the guys that were bringing up the rear, and they forced them onto the snow covered trail that year. And we're like, what is going on? So we're like, you know what? Why don't we just kind of avoid that whole snafu, right? Yeah. Do it in October. The North Rim's still closed, but it's at least should be clear as snow and you can ride the trail, not worry about, don't piss off the park service by riding the closed road. You hop on the trail. You actually get to ride the trail, which is great. And just finish the route as intended. So when you start looking back at the changes going from 19 to 20, and that's when I started really looking at it, like, well, it's really not the 750 anymore. If the route's now, it's a couple, I forget what it ended up being. It was like 822 miles or something that year. But it wasn't just, you know, like a 50, 60 mile change. It was like 140 mile change. Because it wasn't just adding miles, it was replacing miles as well. I think I ended up getting rid of 130 miles of pavement, which is crazy. But and a big stretch of that pavement was in Tonneau Basin by Roosevelt Lake, which is next to Four Peaks in the center of the state. And that's a 30-mile stretch of pavement, and it's littered with resupply. So I was telling people, I was like, well, not only am I getting rid of the pavement, I'm getting rid of all your resupply too. So, and you're getting 9,000 more feet of climbing. So yeah, have fun with that. But the early feedback on it was surprisingly good. It's what the people want. You know, it's a challenge. It's supposed to be hard. We want the finish rate to be around 50%. I'm happy with that. If it becomes 80%, then it's like, you know, I don't know. You know, it's like, well, then let's make it harder. You know, so, and every year it hovers right around 50%, which is, I'm good with that, you know, and I'm glad that like there hasn't been a wait list. I'm fine with that. If I need one, I'll make one, but you know, it's cool. I mean, it's capped at 60, and that's a combined between the 300 and 800. And I believe the last 2 years we were right in the mid 50s, I think. So I thought we were going to hit it last year. We got up to 59 and then a couple of people dropped out right before. And I think it ended up being like 52 at the start or something. So
it's scary, man. The closer I get to riding it, the more scared I become.
Well, I haven't told you what the success rate of the 300 is the last 2 years. Any guess?
Well, I have the numbers. Let's see if I'm right. So in 2023, the finish rate on the 300 was only 13% or no, 16%. And then in 2022, the year before, 26% finish rate. Am I close?
Yeah, I want to say it was 20. I think it was 24% both years.
Okay.
Six out of 25.
Okay. I'm just going off track leaders and I have out of 24, but
yeah. So I don't know if it didn't show any ITTers because I factor the ITTers into.
Yeah. So, yeah. I didn't look at the ITTs. Only the group starts.
Obviously much lower than 50, which is a little surprising because most years the 300 is, I think I want to say a little bit like maybe 50 to 60, but these last 2 years, I was like, whoa, what's going on? Cause the 800, same start, same weather, same everything. The 800 still been at like 50-55%. Yeah. But I was like, I don't know. It's just, but like this past year was really, really hot for the 300. The full three, all 4 days was like pushing 100 degrees. It was brutal. And that was third week in October. I was like, what is going on? It shouldn't be that hot, man.
Yeah, man. I saw those stats when I was preparing for this episode. Like I like did the math and was looking at the finish rate and I was like, holy, like this is, I knew it was going to be challenging, but then like putting it in numbers, I was like, oh man, this is going to be really hard.
Yeah.
And I have a couple questions here, actually probably like 50 questions, but we'll narrow it down. My first question is like, just as a basis of comparison for me, how similar or dissimilar is the Queen's Ransom to the AZT? Obviously Queen's Ransom shorter, but just in terms of like the terrain, the technical side of it, like how similar or dissimilar is it to AZT?
Well, after the 2016 running of the Queen's Ransom, that was, like I said, kind of my first good sized group. The Queen's Ransom got the nickname of being the AZT 300 boot camp. So if that
perfect,
and it's, you know, on bikepacking.com and I believe on bikepacking routes, I think it's rated an 8 out of 10 on the difficulty scale. And yeah, there's some easy miles on the Queen's Ransom, as you know, like the way it starts in the canals is like, all right, so just get rid of that. You know, just let's start the Queen's Ransom when you actually hit single track. And the single track is definitely in line with the AZT. You know, I think the AZT gets a little bit of a bad rap. I mean, maybe that's just because, I mean, those are the, I ride it a lot. It's just, I ride it as day rides and so I'm on it a lot, but even the other area trails around here, they're similar in a lot of regards. I mean, Arizona has a lot of rock. So if you got to be comfortable riding kind of pretty technical terrain, which I like, I enjoy that stuff. So yeah, I mean, it's just, is it demanding? Absolutely. I mean, yeah, there's hike a bike and all that, but I don't think it's so far-fetched amount of hike a bike either, because they do keep making changes and making it more rideable. So, but yeah, I mean, it's more like you have to get into it, kind of get the feel for the trail, right? Like, okay, this is how it's going to go. How do I then pace myself for this style of riding? Because as you'll find out, you definitely don't want to go out balls to the wall and just, because you don't want to just blow up instantly, because then that's really, really hard to recover from. Yeah. And you know, at the end of the day, you do want to have fun, right? That is a goal, right?
I do.
I hope so. But that doesn't mean it can't be really, really difficult and challenging and yet still have fun, right? So then you got to find that balance, like any of these rides. Colorado Trail is no different. It's just a different set of challenges there. Arizona's big challenge is all the pointy things, you know, where's the water, and the trail's pretty technical, but then it also has miles and miles of sweet single track. I think people just forget about it because maybe it goes by too quick and they're into the next difficult part. And they're like, oh my God, we were just hiking a bike. And it's like, dude, that was like 6 hours ago, man. It's like, yeah, you rode 30 miles of great single track coming into Tucson. You forgot about that?
Man. Well, that makes me feel a little bit better. I really enjoyed Queen's Ransom. There was definitely some parts that were like pretty technical. There was like some blacks, maybe double blacks, I don't remember. But for the most part, like, you know, with some good mountain biking skills and used to technical terrain, I found it to be rideable and like a good enjoyable challenge overall. I just got to wrap my head around doing 300 miles of it.
Yeah, but it's good. I mean, if you did enjoy that, then you will enjoy the 300.
Good.
I mean, maybe not parts of Oracle Ridge, but you know, the bad parts don't last forever.
So I keep hearing about Oracle Ridge. Like what is it about Oracle Ridge that makes it so gnarly?
I think part of it is like, you know, it's at the top of Mount Lemmon. So it's like you're like, oh, we finally summited this, you know, 8,000 foot mountain range that's been looming in front of us for days, right? You spend all this energy and pedal power to get up there and you're like, heck yeah, downhill. And then you hit Oracle Ridge and it's like, yeah, nah, there really just isn't this downhill payoff. You know, that's not to say there aren't rideable parts of it, because there are. And now there's one of the major reroutes last year was actually removing the AZT, officially got removed off of the first 2 miles of Oracle Ridge, which at first I was like really bummed, because I was like, man, that's like two of the rideable miles of the Oracle Ridge. I was like, dang it, you know, but then it shifted the one ridge over to Red Ridge. And then I went and pre-rode that. And I was like, well, holy crap, that's like 100% rideable. Now it's steep, but it's not really technical. It's actually fairly smooth, but just make sure your brakes are working like real good. And, but it's like 3.1 miles of just white knuckle kind of heading on down, but it is rideable. Unfortunately, when you get to the bottom of it, it just means you have like a mile and a half hike a bike just to get back to Oracle Ridge, but it's not bad hike a bike. And they've already, and that's on this Catalina Camp Trail, which is an old, I think it's like an old mining road, because you'll go by an old cabin that's up there, which is really cool. And it's right on route, so you get to see that. And once you get on that, it's like this roadbed. So you're like, well, at least for me when I went up, but it was just steep enough where I was like, it's really not worth trying to ride it. It's just easier, less taxing. Just walk it. It's an easy hike a bike. And there was just enough rock on the trail that it was like, it would be more effort than it was worth to try and pedal it. With that said, after the Grand Depart this year, I think it was like 2 weeks after the October start, like before any snows. So this was early November. The ATA already went in and did work on Catalina Camp. So I think they put in like grade reversals and removed some of the rock. So I don't know, maybe it's potentially more rideable ish. So,
I'll report back.
Maybe it's still hike a bike, but maybe it's just easier hike a bike. I don't know. So anyway,
I'll send you my notes.
So then I guess to answer your question, you hit Oracle Ridge. Now you'll get back on it at this place called Dan's Saddle. It's like this intersection of these Jeep roads, and you get on the trail and just instantly go almost straight up. start hiking. And what makes Oracle Ridge difficult is like, it can be steep hike a bike, but there's also just enough like fairly large boulders on the trail. So you're not just rolling your bike. You have to then pick your bike up maybe like 2 feet, get it up by this boulder. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then you're also getting poked in the face by, you know, cat claw and, you know, Palo Verdes and manzanita bushes. So you're fighting vegetation also. And you're also having like, all right, well, make sure I don't slip off the trail because it's also on a, you know, a slope. So there's a little bit of penalty for failure, you know? So, but wow, look at those views. You know, I can see Phoenix from here. I mean, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, so it's just that, right? You know,
full on AZT experience.
But,
yeah,
but does it go on for like 5 miles? No, not really. I mean, so it initially kind of is like that for, I don't even know, maybe a mile or two. And then you get through it and then you're like, oh, okay, I can start riding it now because it maybe levels out a little bit. And you're like, oh, okay. And then, but then you'll be like, all right, I'll probably want to walk this section. And then, oh, there's a gate. You know, you go through that. Oh, good. I'm on a Jeep road. Cool. Oh my God. Those are like watermelon sized rocks on this downhill Jeep road. Like, really? Like, well, I think I can ride it. Well, maybe not. You know, so it's just one of those, you know, and then when you finally get down, you're like, all right, I'm through the gauntlet. I can finally start riding again and you're done.
Yeah, that's Oracle. It sounds like a little bit of everything or a lot of everything.
It is. I've done it in 2 feet of snow. I've done it in 2 inches of snow. I've done it when it's been trimmed. I've done it when it's not been trimmed. I've done it in daylight. I've done it in darkness. Yeah, whatever. It's cool. It's hard.
It's part of the experience, man.
Yeah. Just get some really nice photos up there. It's you get great views.
I'll bring my camera. So what is it, if you could try to encapsulate, you know, what is it that makes the Arizona Trail so hard? And I mean, speaking of it being hard, like a 25% finish rate, you know, a 50% finish rate is like considered kind of the sweet spot for you. I mean,
yeah.
So what's contributing to so many DNFs? Like what makes it so hard?
Probably like any of these big races, it's just, it's everything, right? I mean, here for sure, the heat is definitely a factor. How well you plan for it, how you just deal with it. Like now this last year, for example, a couple guys on the 800 were really, really struggling with it. I think they were from Alaska. And I was like, man, I really feel for those guys. They're coming from that environment. They come down here in October, like, all right, let's go. And I know they're strong riders. And then it's 102 degrees. And they're like, oosh. And you can see it even by 20 miles into the race, like, man, they're already struggling. And so what they did was like, you know what? We're really having difficulty in the heat. So we're going to just not ride from 10 to 3. We're going to sleep. I'll ride at night. You know, you do what works for you. So yeah, I mean, I've seen plenty of people take siestas in the heat of the day. If you find a shady spot, just deal with it. Right. And then, you know, it's, and then obviously you have all the, you know, the bike mechanicals, that's always part of it too, which, you know, pick a route, right? Your route, Queens Ransom, AZT, Colorado, it doesn't matter, right? You know, you bike mishap, you're done, right? It's another thing I think that just plays with people's minds on the AZT is the hike a bike. And it's not that there's just so much of it. I think it's the, not even the, like in the Colorado trail race, right? Everybody knows there's a lot of hike a bike, but in Colorado, when you start walking, you're like, all right, well, I'm hiking for like the next 3 hours because I got this 12,000 foot mountain pass I have to get over and it's steep. And you just start walking. So you walk for 3 hours, you get to the top. All right, that's done. And then you start riding again. The AZT, it's like you come around a corner and you see a couple of rocks. You're like, you try to get through it. Or you're like, nah, I can't do that. So you hop off your bike. You walk for like 15 seconds, right? And then the trail looks great. You hop on the bike, you go around a corner, and then there's another rock obstacle. You're like, oh, all right, and up, hop off the bike again. And then you're on the bike for like a minute, and then there's another one. So it's like that kind of stuff. If you're not prepared for the on off kind of hike a bike, it just messes with you. And some people just get so frustrated with that. They're like, you know what? Nah, it just, and you know how it is. When you just say I'm done, you're done.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Once you check
and
out
it
mentally.
It happens to everybody. I mean, you look down the years and years of the finish rates, right? And you go down and you scroll right to the DNF list because we put it out there, and you look at the people on the DNF list and you're like, wow, that's a really strong rider right there. Like, what, wonder what happened with, what was the story there? Oh, he crashed and crashed out, got injured. Oh, okay. You know, and then this one, yeah, just wasn't feeling it. Well, you know, but what does that mean? Right. I don't know. Pickery, right. Was it just too hot that year? Was it, you just weren't mentally prepared for the hike a bike? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
It just varies, man. It's just,
it's everything. Like you said, I mean, it's
and it
the
just
terrain.
Sounds like, I don't know. Cliche,
bike,
just like
weather. Yeah.
Not like even a real answer. Right. But it's true. I mean, I don't know. Cause it's happened to me. I mean, I DNF'd 2017 on the 300 because I was dehydrated before it even started. And I found that out about 5 miles into it. I was like, uh-oh, it's a hot year. And I'm in trouble. And I struggled big time that day and I fought through it. And somehow I ground out like 85 miles that day and I slept on it. And the next day I was on, and I knew, I was like, all right, I'm in a good spot. I got through a lot of the difficult stuff. I have easy trail in the Tucson the next day. I'm going to resupply and I'm going to be all right. And then that next day came and I'm on the easy stuff. And I just couldn't even do it. I was just like, I just got nothing. And now, I'm staring at Mount Lemmon and I was like, I can't do that. I have no power. I have nothing. And at that point, I'm like, well, what am I going to do? Like just take 2 days off and try to recover. I mean, for me, it's like, I'm local. What's the point? Right.
Yeah.
So I'm done. So there you go.
Well, that's a good segue. Speaking of Mount Lemmon, and circling back just briefly to the hike a bike, the hike a bike is one of the questions I wanted to ask you, but you actually answered the question quite well. It's kind of like, I was curious, like, is a lot of hike a bike like due to elevation or, you know, grade, or is it technical? So it sounds like it's like, kind of hard to get your flow on some of it, and you're just kind of like on and off, on and off.
Yeah.
But Lemmon Push, I hear that's
ding,
pretty
ding,
hard.
Ding.
That's a true hike a bike, right? That's everybody's putting their bike on their back, or, you know, what are we in for there?
Well, so good news for you, the 300, you don't have to do it.
Really?
Really?
It's optional.
It is. That was put in for the 800 because the 800, I just figured it just got to a point where, like, you know what, if you're signing up for the 800, you've already agreed to putting your bike on your back for 21 miles through the Grand Canyon. And I've yet to really hear anybody say when they reach the North Rim, like, oh, that was easier than I thought it was going to be. You know, usually it's like, that was about the hardest thing I've ever done with my bike. Like, that was ridiculously stupid, but kind of cool. So part of the reason for the Lemmon Push and I won't shy away from saying that, the five single speeders that did it voluntarily the year before had something to say with this. Yeah, absolutely. Cause they all did it. They all finished the route. So I was like, well, obviously it can be done. And like I told you, even, you know, with the reroutes and things like that, Lemmon Push was no different. I was like, well, I'm going to go down and I'm going to do it myself because I'm not going to make anybody else go do it without me myself seeing what they're in for. So I did it down last spring and it was a hot day. It was like 90 degrees when I started at the bottom of Green Mountain. Cause actually a couple months before I went to do the whole thing from Bug Springs all the way up, and I did Bug Springs and I just was feeling like shit. So I was like, you know what, today's just not the day. I'll finish Bug Springs and I'll come back, you know, in the fall. And that's what I did. I went back in I think it was late September, a couple weeks before the Grand Depart, and I did it. And it was weird. It was oddly satisfying. You know, it was just one of those things. Like, yeah, that was really difficult. It was like 75% hike a bike, but that was kind of cool. And I was like, yeah, I think the 800, they need to do that. And that was it. I pretty much made the decision that day to send the 800 up, but I didn't want to send the 300 riders up there because a lot of people, I don't want to say maybe not a lot, but the 300 can be like maybe some people's first bike pack race.
It was your first bike packing race.
Yeah. So it's like, I don't think it needs to be, as we just noted last year and the year before, the finish rate was 24%. And that was people riding up the pavement on Mount Lemmon. I don't think I need to make it any more difficult. It's pretty hard as is. Right. So we'll just leave the 300 as is, and you'll still get your fair amount of hike a bike on Lemon, because even though the push part of it was kind of like officially starts at Bug Springs, really it starts at the base of the Molino hike a bike. That's where the big hike a bike begins, and the 300 has to do that because there's no way around it. So there's this pretty good, probably a good 40-45 minute hike a bike up over Molino, and then you get up over this saddle, you drop down, you hit the pavement, and there's Molino campground is there. And then the trail, you don't get on the pavement there. You actually stay on the AZT for another 2 miles up to this Gordon Hirabashi trailhead, which we call prison camp. And that's where you get on the pavement.
Oh, I remember that prison camp. That's where they like,
yeah.
Didn't it like not have walls or anything? And they would like move it while they were building the road over up to Mount.
Something like that. I keep forgetting to read the plaque that they have there.
I read it like 4 or 5 years ago when I was there, and I remember driving up Mount Lemon. So that's the road you're talking about. Yeah, it's like you hop on that road and I mean, you see tons of cyclists there, but they're not on fully loaded bikes and they're on skinny tires, and
very popular road climb for the Tucson riders, which if I lived down there, I'd be climbing it all the time. But so for the 300, you'll get on the pavement there, and I want to say it's 14 mile climb. So it's not easy. I mean, yeah, it's paved, but it's a grind, and it's not steep, but it's definitely not like a granny gear climb, but even with bike packing gear, you can at least get up a gear or two, you know, and just kind of grind it out. So
yeah, I'm coming from sea level though. That's the thing, is like it's Texas, where we don't have mountains. So there's so much, it just depends on where you're
going. A couple of days under your belt before you get there. And you know, it's the start of the race, which people, I think, overlook. They just assume, oh, you're Southern Arizona, it's the desert, it's low elevation. Like, well, no, the start of the race is, I think, like 5,500 feet at the border. And then you get up over 6,000, like right away in the Canelo Hills. So you're like in the 5,000-6,000 foot range for a while. Mm-hmm. And then you drop low as you come into Tucson. That's when you actually really hit the desert. And the saguaros is when you hit Tucson. And then down there, that's where it could be hot, depending on the forecast. And then you're at like 2,000 feet there. And then, you top out the top of Lemon, I think, is the 300. You get just below Mount Bigelow. So I want to say maybe 8,200 feet, somewhere in there.
Yeah, it's up there.
Yeah. So then you'll go through Summer Haven, which is right around upper sevens or something like that. And
the highest I've ridden up to is 11,200. Okay. And I got altitude sickness too, but I don't think I'll be dealing with that at 8,000.
No, for sure. Plus you don't stay there. You're up and over. So that's the nice thing about it too. So even
I'm just
going
to ride myself into adapting to the elevation. I mean, I just plan on taking it slow and not pushing I'll just have to work within what I have. Yeah. I don't have the ability to get there with my schedule to get there earlier to like acclimatize, unfortunately. So, I'm not going to put a lot of pressure on myself to go off the gate real hard, but hopefully by the time I get to Mount Lemon, I'll be a little bit more acclimatized to.
Yeah, you will be. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the right attitude to take with it too. Because the Canelo Hills, you'll find out right away, like what it is. Every year, man, it's just, people just think like, all right, the race, it's on. And somebody just like blows up in there.
That's not me.
They're tough. They're tough, but they're awesome. I really like the Canelos, but there's two pretty decent hike a bikes in the Canelo Hills East. So that's my little pro tip for you. Once you get through those and you reach Canelo Pass Road, it's a dirt road that you cross. That's the transition from east to west. You're through the hardest part of the Canelo Hills. And that's about roughly the halfway point. And the west side of the Canelos ride much better. And then you even halfway through the west, you hit the new single track in there. And then that's where you get into the whole Casablanca Canyons, which is just fantastic. That is just amazing.
So, I love that desert scenery, man. I mean, that's what really draws me. That's why I want to do the AZT, is mostly, I just love a desert landscape, and that area around Arizona is just amazing. I can't wait to see more of it.
I've lived here now for 31 years and I just love it. I try not to take it for granted because it's just so unique. You know, it's just never gets old. don't know. Yeah. It's awesome.
What about food and water? Like, what do you recommend? Like, how much water do you recommend, like, the average? Because obviously it depends, like, how fast you're going, how much distance, how hot it is. But just, like, as a general guideline, how much food and water should people be carrying?
Man. Well, that's like the million-dollar question, right? You know, and it's like, oh, here we go, you know? But so I guess my answer or my disclaimer is, like, for me personally, again, living here as long as I have, I'm kind of a camel. I'm out there riding when it's hot out, and I think I'm drinking gallons, right? And I'll even do this in the summer. I'll go out and, like, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it's like 110. And I'll be chugging water, and I'll finish like a 2 hour ride, and I'll look and I'm like, man, I barely drank a liter. And I thought I went through like three, you know, and I'm like, what, like, what's wrong with me? You know, like, I mean, I don't know, but so take that for what it's worth. Right.
Yeah.
So with that said, when I've done the 300 and 752, you know, once you get past picket post, the whole topography and elevation changes for the Northern Arizona. So the 300 is essentially the desert portion. Right. You know, I'm the type of rider that I always would err on the side of just carrying more than I thought I needed, which for me, 3 liters was always like, that seemed like a lot. Like, okay. Like for me, like from the start until wherever that first reliable water source was, which was usually back then it was Patagonia, which was 30 plus miles away. I'm like, well, yeah, 3 liters, I can get 30 miles. No problem. Whatever. And I had always made it before. So I mean, I guess 3 liters. Now there's, again, what's your strategy? Like, some people are like, I like to go light. I like to, like, these guys that show up and they do 2 water bottles, but then they're also wanting to use like every known water source along the way, be it a good, bad, indifferent, right? Which, that's fine. But, you know, if I don't have to filter from a crappy cattle tank, I don't do that. I'm like, that first year I finished the 300 in 2013, I did the whole thing with, I don't think I filtered water once. I went straight water, reliable source to reliable source. I think the most I ever carried was 6 liters, and that was leaving Tucson to head up Mount Lemmon. And it was pretty warm that year too. I don't think it was like record heat, but it was above normal. So pushing mid 90s, and it was definitely hot along the Gila. So it can be done. So you just have, again, you need to do your research on, like, okay, where are my known good water sources? What's the distance in between? You know, what style of rider am I? For me, I'm like, even during the race, I'm a a self-proclaimed back of the mid-pack racer. So take that for what you will. You know, like I said, my best time on the 300 is 3 days, 22 and 30, you know, which I think the average time is like maybe in the 312 range, I think, somewhere in there. But that doesn't mean a lot of people now with some of the reroutes, or maybe it's closer to 4 days now is the average race time. So, you know, you take that for what it's worth, right? Are there known dry areas? Yeah, if it's a drier year, leaving Tucson can be tough. Now in the 300, if you're going up the road, there's a spigot at the Mount Bigelow trailhead, which is across the street from the Palisade Ranger Station, but that's pretty close to the top anyway. So you're almost in Summer Haven, unless you're like completely out, then yeah, you know, stop and get some water, but you only have probably less than an hour from there anyway. But that's a big stretch. And then even now the desert section leaving Oracle isn't as daunting as it used to be. Cause before it was like, all right, you leave Oracle and it's, you know, if you went off route into town, let's say to resupply at a convenience store. So from there to the finish, it's about 95 miles to picket post. And it's just, we call it the void. It's just desert all the way, but it's some of the best riding you'll ever do. And in years past, it was like, well, there's that water, the public water cache at Freeman Road. It's like, oh, is there going to be water there or not? Well, now they installed a rain collector there. So there's water at Freeman Road now. You don't even have to worry about it. You should filter it, though. They do recommend filtering it out of the rain collector because there is a random stray shot that, a pigeon could fly over and drop some something in the tank. So, yes, it could happen. But it is pretty well shielded. And then there's the Gila River, which we generally tell people to, you know, not filter out of that because it's all downstream from an active copper mine. So heavy metals, you know, I've filtered, I've drank out of it before. I didn't think it was bad, but you know, I definitely wouldn't drink out of it every day. But
yeah,
now,
you don't recommend it unless you need to.
But when you hit the river is the town site of Kelvin. There's no services there, but that's the place that's kind of famous for having the pizza delivery out of Kearney.
I've heard of this. Yes.
Oh yeah. You can actually have a pizza delivered to the trailhead. But just make sure you throw your trash
Kearney
away.
Pizza. Yeah. So you have to call them and they'll deliver it to you at the trail.
Well, there's an ADOT maintenance yard there and there's a spigot, right? And this is like 100 yards off the trail. It's super convenient to access and they'll deliver the pizza right to you.
Love that trail angel.
So, yeah, I know, right? Crazy. I think it's like a $10 delivery fee, but everybody's like, yeah, so what? Right? Yeah. I mean, I'm getting a pizza on the AZT. Hell yeah. So obviously you can get good water there or from, you know, the Kearney pizza. And then there's the second rain collector is on the climb away from the Gila River. And that's about 12 miles before you reach picket post. So again, you grab water there. So it's like, so there's water in the desert. It's great.
Yeah.
So yeah, you just plan it. So do you have to carry 6 liters leaving Oracle? I mean, yeah, probably not. I mean, unless you're one of those people that, yeah, I just go through a lot of water. Well, then yeah, go prepared, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're going to be, you know, for me, I'm going to be in a drier and higher climate.
Right.
So it's just going to be sucking the moisture out of me from what I'm in a very humid hot climate here. And plus, like, one of my biggest fears is running out of water. Like, I just, I don't want to play that game. And so I'm the type of person where I'll carry extra water. I don't mind the water weight because you pack your fears, right? Like everybody knows you pack your fears. One of my fears is running out of water. I don't want to play that game. I'll have a water filter on me. And even if I don't like necessarily need to drink out of one of those nasty cattle troughs, like if I'm running kind of a little bit borderline, I might just fill some and has it as like a safety blanket, you know?
Absolutely. And that's just being smart, you know? So, and you'll know once you're out there, like, oh, it's a little warmer than I thought it was going to be. Or yeah, the dryness is really affecting me. Right. And yet make sure you have chapstick. Oh God. Yes. Sunblock. So it's a different climate. It takes some getting used to, especially when you coming from somewhere like where you live. So
what about, I wanted you to touch on the cache boxes and what your guidelines are for people who are riding the AZT specifically.
Yeah, like, well, especially for the, you know, the race, right? It's like, yes, they're public cache boxes, so yeah, are you allowed to use it? Yeah, you know, but we do, I guess I want to say frown upon it, but there's like a couple of strategic ones, right? Because there's now actually a lot of boxes on the route. But at the end of the day, bikers really don't need it. We can cover so much ground. And again, if you do your research, you'll actually probably be pretty surprised at how much water is available out there.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, and against what may or may not be out there, no, people don't stock the caches for bike riders, like whatsoever. I mean, there are trail angels that live nearby some of these, and yeah, they do on occasion, you know, check them and take out empties and put some full ones in, but usually that's for the hikers. And we just tell the racers and the riders that, you know, and if you do need to use it, just use it like to top off a little bit. Definitely don't show up to one completely dry and be like, all right, I'm taking like a gallon and a half out of this cache. I mean, it's just not cool. With that said, last year there's a box when you get over the Molino hike a bike right near the Molino campground, and knowing how dry Mount Lemmon was last year and how hot it was last year, I was like, you know what? This box is going to be probably used kind of like what the Freeman Road one was before they put the rain collector in. It's sort of out in the middle of nowhere. And if it's hot, it's just one of those spots where I know people are just going to use it. I mean, I'm not naive to that fact, right? So myself and I think two other people last year, I think before the race started, we had like 58 gallons in that box just because I was like, you know what? I don't need people being in distress out there either. And come to find out, I don't think really all that many people ended up using it, which I was a little surprised to hear that, but I know people did, and that's fine. But I also know people weren't using all the other boxes. It, like I said, it's just not necessary. Like, there's a box at the Kelvin Trailhead, and it's 2 miles away from the ADOT yard. So it's like, well, why would you even need to use that? I mean, yeah. It's downhill to the ADOT yard. Like, I mean, you're there in like, you know, 5 minutes. Just go get free water right there. Just leave the stuff there. And, yeah. and more yeah. often than not, if you open the box and you look in there, a lot of them are marked specifically for hikers, which that definitely do not ever use something marked for a hiker. They are counting on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I guess that's my 2 cents on it. You're like, yeah, they're there. You know, are you allowed? Yeah. But yeah, don't.
Yeah.
You just don't need it. You know, unless, like you said, oh my God, it's 100 degrees out. I was prepared. I had 8 liters, but man, I'm running low. I still got, you know, X amount of miles to go. I should probably grab a liter or two. All right, then yeah, do it. I mean, don't die out there.
So, yeah, don't die, but do your homework at home and with proper planning and an honest assessment of who you are, how fast you're riding and all this stuff. You can plan for success and you don't need to drain somebody else's potential resources that's out there hiking the trail.
Yeah. Yep.
So let's touch on a little bit. You and I have texted about this offline, but just for the podcast, like obviously everybody has a different personal preference. And so this is kind of like a wide question, but but whenever it comes to bike, like what kind of bike, like specifically like bike and tire, you know, what kind of tire do you want to be running? What size, how durable, like what do you want to consider from your gear from that perspective when you're riding the AZT?
Well, just first of all, I guess just based on bikes that people tend to ride out here, not like what I ride, it seems like it's a pretty, I think it's pretty even between full suspension and hardtail, maybe starting to lean a little bit more towards full suspension nowadays, but you know, do you need it? No. With that said, I mean, I've ridden out here 30 plus years, 28 of them on a hardtail, and it's just what I have. Am I like against full suspension? No, I just can't afford one. So I keep trying to tell my wife, like, come on, I'm getting older, man. I need more cush. But yeah, I mean, I'd be all for riding one, but I don't have one. So no, I've got a hardtail. It's a Thai hardtail that's pseudo softish tail in the back because it has some good flexibility. And I run a 130 fork up front. I run 2.6s front and back. I've been doing that for years. To me, that's kind of like the sweet size. I like it. I probably wouldn't go anything less than 2.4, but people run them on 3.0s as well and are happy with that. So at the end of the day, it's sort of like run what you brung, you know, like again, single speeders, they do it. They love it. All right, cool. We've had single speed rigid. It's like, okay. Would I recommend about single speed probably not, but they did it. All right. You know,
fixie rigid. Have you ever had fixie rigid?
Like, was it Nate Ginson who won it the first year we did the 800? He was on a full on drop bar gravel bike.
Oh my gosh.
He finished it. But then people ask him, oh, would you do it? And he's like, heck no, I wouldn't do that again. I'd go full on, you know, hardtail, at least front suspension mountain bike. So, can it be done? Yeah. Should it be done? Probably not. You know, tires, I said the width, the main thing with tires is the durability, you know, leave your thin walled cross country race tires at home. AZT doesn't want any part of that. They'll eat that stuff up for lunch. You know, make sure, you know, tubeless is pretty key out here because there's cactus everywhere. Even the stuff you don't see, there's probably cactus needles on the trail. You will run over them. And just, you know, it just seals instantly and just kind of eliminate that. I mean, I can't remember the last tube that I put in my bike. I don't know, 2018, maybe, I don't know, 16. I can't remember. And I even run
tubeless technology has gotten so good.
And I make my own sealant. I've just been doing homebrew sealant for like 9 years or 8 years or something. It's just,
holy shit. Yeah. That should be a whole nother podcast about how to make your own homemade sealant.
It's 30 seconds, man. you go to the craft store, you buy the 16 ounce thing of the latex mold builder, and then it's 3 parts water to 1 part mold builder. Done.
Oh, wow. You just put Stan's and Orange Seal out of business.
And it's like a quarter of the cost. I mean, I don't know. Just as good for me. For me, most of the punctures are just the cactus needles. I can go out of my bike right now in the garage. I can count all the wet spots on my tires. There's probably like 80 holes in each tire and they both have air. It's fine. It's just, you know, welcome to Arizona in the desert. That's just what it is.
I love that. What about how aggressive does the tread need to be? Should you err on the side of like maybe a little bit faster rolling, or do you want something like a really aggressive tread, like somewhere in the middle? Like, what do you think is a good tire?
Yeah, maybe something in the middle, I guess. And that's really personal preference.
Sure.
For me, I've always kind of gone middle of the road. Like I've been running these Terravel honchos. I really like those, but I've run like Maxxis Ardents before. I know a lot of people like the Icons. I've had bad luck with Icons. I swore them off, but whatever.
I love the Icons. I'm in the Icon camp.
Yeah. So, you know, that tread, but I mean, that's a popular tread out here. So okay, again, good. If it's a good tire for you, it'd be fine. I just, not right. me.
That's a tire I would love to run. And actually I'm with you on the full suspension. One of my listeners let me borrow, that's sitting over there, a Carbon S-Works stump jumper or one of their jumpers or something.
Yeah.
It's like a $7,000 bike that he let me borrow. Yikes. But I'm not used to riding a full suspension. I really like to ride a hardtail. So I'm like really on the fence about what bike I'm going to run because I have a Thai hardtail with suspension. But if I run the Thai hardtail with suspension, my ideal setup, I was thinking, would be a 2.6 inch tire, and I would love to ride in the Icon. But my concern was that it wasn't like grippy enough for Arizona potentially.
No, it's fine as far as the tread pattern goes. No, that's fine. The key with really any tire is like how durable are your sidewalls? I mean, really, because it's the rocks. Like I said, everything here is sharp and everything is out to get you. The plants are, the rocks are, the creatures are. I mean, just everything is. So, you know, the sun is out to get you. I mean, it's just like, all right, you know, game on, you know. But durability is key for me. Like for me, a heavy tire, like I don't care. Is it going to last through the backcountry? Yeah, all right, I'm putting it on. You know, it's like, I don't care.
Heavy tire is way better than carrying, you know, four extra tubes or spending the time to fix your tire, sew it up, whatever you need to do. I mean, penalty and keep pedaling.
Yeah. Yep. So that's just my preference. That's the way I roll. So
one last question on gear.
Yep.
For camping, I got a flat in my air mattress. So like one, do you discourage people from using air mattresses because everything's trying to poke you? And do you encourage like some kind of tent to keep snakes, spiders, scorpions like off of you? Or can you cowboy camp? Like what's a good camping setup?
Well, let's see. I've gone through 5 or 6 air mattresses, but yet I still use one. And the one I have now, it's like one of those Nemo, I forget. I don't know if that's the model of it. I already forget. It's the orange one. It's kind of bulky actually, but it's one of those that if it actually would go flat, there's still a little bit of padding there. So that's kind of why I went to it, because I was puncturing so many of them and they kept warrantying them. And I'm like, it's just not working, you know? And it's not like I would just lay it down. I have ground cover and I would check the area and then like, what am I doing wrong? Like, I don't get it. So yeah. I don't know, maybe I'm just cursed with air mattresses, but this one, knock on wood, I've had it now, I think over a year, maybe even two. Yeah. I think, over 2 years now already and still going. And, but yeah, it doesn't pack down as small. So I just switched the way that I carry it now, but it works for me. And it's thick enough that I can sleep on my side, you know, and it's comfortable enough. So yeah, I mean, you can use an air mattress, but yeah. Be as careful as possible when you do choose a campsite, if you can. I mean, and again, there's a lot of washes here. So there is sand, which is soft, and there actually is a lot of soft places to camp here in Arizona, even in the desert. So it's not all razor sharp rocks and cactus everywhere, although it does seem that way sometimes. And then
one note on the air mattress, when Miles and I did your Queen's Ransom route, I have a Neo Extra Light, whatever. It still has a hole in it from the first night of camping on Queen's Ransom. Right. And that first night we were on concrete. So we were on concrete and it's still got a flat. And I had a flat air mattress. We went to a store and tried to find the hole, and I was in some parking lot pouring water on it. I still have yet to find the hole. Like I've done that too.
I even put mine to the bathtub test, and I'm like, I see no holes. So then I would leave it inflated. I come back 10 minutes later and it's like flat. So I'm like, all right, well, it's obviously leaking. So what the hell? And I was like, I'll just send it back and have them replace it or whatever. And it was just weird. But like for me, when I do the races, I don't take that pad. I'm like, well, I'm not here to sleep. Right. But I don't do the whole sleep deprivation thing. I need at least 4 hours. So I take like this little 1 square foot foldable foam pad just for my hip when I'm racing. And I just stuck that under my hip and I'm like, all right, I can get a couple hours with that. And then when it's like uncomfortable, usually the sun's coming up and I just go and I call it good. But when I'm out more casual, like Queen's Ransom, I'm taking my sleeping pad and getting a good night's sleep. So, but as far as to cowboy camp or not cowboy camp, for me, like for the 300, I'm just checking the forecast. If I see 0% chance of rain, I'm cowboy camping it. Like I do that all the time and I don't even think twice about it. The only thing I look for when I'm going to make a campsite is like, is there like an anthill or something nearby, like the pesky little critters. I've never been worried about like snakes, scorpions, that kind of stuff. I've never had any issues with any of that in all the years I've been out here doing it. And it's just a non-issue to me. But if I see like the first year doing the 300 in 2012, when there was that chance of storm, then it was like, I'd take probably a bivy or something like that just in case it would start raining.
So mostly just for weather, not for critters or anything.
You're correct. But again, that's personal preference, you know, I get it. Yeah. Some people get freaked out by that. And if taking a bivy makes you comfortable, take a bivy.
Absolutely.
Peace of mind, right? And just if it's going to really mess with your head and affect your sleep, then take a bivy, you know, be comfortable, do what's right.
I like cowboy camping. So that again, but it always comes down to personal preference. And if you enjoy that style of camping or if you'd rather be in a tent or some kind of shelter, and I'm just looking at ways to, I want to have the most minimal kit possible while also having everything that I legitimately need. And so, you know, the tent or the bivy is like one of the areas where it's like, okay, question mark, you know, is this something I want to carry or, to be determined. We'll have to check the weather and see how it goes.
And I'm doing it right now at the Queen's Ransom. It was just like a couple of days ago, Saturday night, when we're out on the AZT, it was showing 40% chance of showers. And I was like, crap. I wanted to cowboy camp the whole thing, you know? And then yesterday it dropped down to 20%. So now I'm like, well, all right. I still got another day and a half to decide if I want to carry one or not. So I probably will, but I was like, I really don't want to. But
worst thing is to not have it when you really absolutely need it, you know? So having that peace of mind and just be able to ride and not worry about it is kind of nice.
That was my 2021 300 ITT. When I cherry picked my weather window, March 11th, perfect weather. Check the 10-day forecast, 72, I think 60 on Mount Lemmon, and then like 70 and 70 for 5 days, mid 40s and 50 at night. I'm like, perfect. 5 days before I'm supposed to go, look, now a storm's rolling in right in the middle. What was it? A 30% chance of like 2 to 3 inches of snow on Mount Lemmon. I'm like, right when I was going to hit Mount Lemmon, I'm like, I've done Oracle Ridge of a couple inches of snow. It's no big deal, but I should pack gear for it. So, all right. Well, and I was going to cowboy camp that one. So I took my bivy, took my rain gear, took my lobster mitts, took my waterproof socks, you know, because I should be prepared. I didn't want to take any of that stuff. Well, what happened? I get on Mount Lemmon and I wake up the morning of day three and I'm down on the bottom of Mount Lemmon and there's already 9 inches of snow and it's dumping. And I hear the snow plow running up the road. And I was like, well, at least the roads are clear. So up I go. So I rode up the road in a driving snowstorm. I get to the top and where I was going to get a burger and beer at the grill. Well, that was closed because the whole town was closed because they shut the road down in public. And there were through hikers in the community center and they were heading out on Oracle Ridge. So I was like, all right, well, I'll be behind you, make some good tracks. And there ended up being like 2-foot snowdrifts on Oracle Ridge. And I loaded up on food in the general store there. And yeah, I went out in it in 30-mile-an-hour crosswinds, but I was prepared. I had all the food. I had my water. I had all my gear on, and I was pretty comfortable. I was, I guess, sickly looking forward to it. It was really weird. It was just like, all right, I'm prepared for it. Let's just go. Just keep moving. And I was like, well, as soon as I drop elevation, I'll be able to start riding. Yeah, no.
Well, it kind of validates you carrying all that stuff, right? Oh, it's like, absolutely. I carried it all the way here. At least I get to use it now.
Yeah. And the number one thing ended up being the waterproof socks. My feet were just cozy the whole time. But it was crazy. It took me 8 hours to go 10 miles.
Oh my gosh.
It was just nuts. But I got some awesome pictures. So I was like, yeah, whatever. But needless to say, my 312 goal that year was shot. but I did finish. So I was like, yeah, sweet.
That's the ultimate goal, is just finishing. And then everything else is just bonus.
Yeah. It was the slowest of my three finishes, but yet the one I'm probably most proud of, because I didn't quit. So
yeah,
it was pretty cool.
Well, I'll try to take a page out of your playbook. My goal is to finish. I just want to, I can. I know I can. But things are going to go wrong. I just don't know exactly what they are, and things are going to be hard, and I don't know what exactly or when it's going to come. And so, I'm going to try to just, it's so much different than the kind of riding I do here in Texas, which is flat, mostly gravel roads. And it's, you know, you're just going. And so it's going to be a much different approach to riding than just what I'm used to. And so I'm just going to try to go in with like a really, I want to say like a laid back, not super pressure, just kind of roll with the punches and take what the trail gives me and just work through it and not get overly frustrated. Or like you said, I mean, if I need to take a nap in the middle of the day, I've kind of mentally prepared myself for, hey, maybe you're hot and you just need to sleep for a couple hours, and that's okay, you know? And so,
well, like they say too, is like, this is your first run, right? This is the scouting mission, right?
Yes.
And hopefully it's a finishing scouting mission, but it's still a scouting mission. And then you come back next time, guns blazing, right?
Yeah, for sure. I hope I finish it, but no matter what, like, these experiences are always great teachers. I mean, even if you don't finish one, you learn so much. I mean, just researching the trail, preparing for it, you have all that information. Then you know the terrain a little bit better. You know what went wrong so you can prepare for it. I mean, it's never a loss if you take it as a learning experience, you know?
Yep. Agreed.
Well, let's put a little bit of a bow on it. Wrap up with some helpful information for the listeners. The first thing I wanted to address or bring up was, like you mentioned, anyone riding the trail should send a donation to the Arizona Trail Association. I don't know if there's anything else you want to add there. Also, in that vein, are there any other like permitting requirements or anything that people need to know about before they go ride the AZT?
Yeah. So as far as the donation stuff goes, that'd be really, really cool if people did that. Or you can even become an ATA member. I believe they start at $35 a year, but then you get access to all their trail guides and the maps and more detailed info on the website.
That's a good deal.
So yeah, and if you're not familiar, the ATA website is aztrail.org, short and sweet.
Perfect.
So yeah, you can go on there, and I believe there's a big donate button right on the homepage and all that stuff. And one of the links on their page, they do have like a mountain biking page on the ATA website. So there's some mountain biking resources there, which is great. And then obviously you want to research like the ATA website, and I believe becoming a member, then you get access to their water data, which, now granted, this is for the full AZT, which, you know, we have some bypasses, but it's definitely applies to the 300 route and the full 800 for all the miles that you're on the AZT. You can get the water details and things like that. And the Far Out app is that's the AZT app. A lot of the hikers are really good about updating the water sources on there. So
that's like a crowdsource app, kind of like, there's an Overlander where you can like know where to park and know where to camp. And
it's through Far Out. I want to say it's $9.99, but it's like a one-time thing. You're done and get all the updates. Wow. And so I bought that years ago, and I still use it every once in a while when I go out there. So that's really cool and helpful. So yeah, definitely poke around on their website. A lot of good info there. Then you have like, you know, the race website is AZT300-800.com. And a lot of good info there.
Yeah, I'll echo that. I mean, I've revisited that website for years on and off, but like I took a deep dive when I was preparing for this episode. And I mean, really, like almost every question I could ask is pretty well covered on that website. So it's an excellent resource.
That's what I tried to do, because it's like, well, I don't, not that I'm against getting emails from people. I mean, I like to hear from people, but I don't need to be getting the same emails over and over and over again. So I was like, oh, why not make an FAQ page? Duh. Yeah. So let's just start there. So yeah, when you get to that, go on FAQs and that'll probably answer a lot of your questions. And on the results page, you can see obviously how fast or slow people do it. But if somebody has a ride report, we link their ride reports on the results page. So you can go down, if somebody's name is underlined, like a hyperlink, just click on it and you'll pull up their ride report. Even if it's 10 years old, the route might have changed over the years, but you'd still get a sense of what you're in for. And a lot of them is still very pertinent. So, but yeah, and like you said, just because I went to the La Posta Quemada Ranch in 2016 and got a burrito, you can't do that anymore. They closed. So, you know, you got to do that research, but you can get a burrito at the Colossal Cave, which is like right next door. So
that's so funny. I learned all that in my research. Like I was reading your blog and the La Posta burrito, and then I went to look for the burrito and I couldn't find it, but I found the cave that's there and I made a note of that one. So I'm doing my homework too.
Well, it was funny because when I got it in 2016 and 2017, the year I DNF, though, I made it there and I was telling a couple of the riders that I was riding with, I was like, oh, we're going to go get some burritos at the ranch. And we get down there and it was closed. And it was like, I was so bummed. I was like, cause I didn't know about it. I was like, well, I guess I didn't do my research. I was like, dang it. I was like, well, at least we got water there. But you know, live and learn. And
so what other resources do you think? So we got ArizonaTrail.org. We got the Far Out app, the your race route, which is AZT300-800.com.
Yep.
Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say those are the two main ones. You can get just about everything you need there. Like the Instagram account, that's, you know, whatever. That's just for kind of like just getting signed up and stuff. Yeah. I mean, if you care, it's at AZT300_800, but you know, whatever.
So as far as like the most updated route, is that just hosted on AZT300-800.com? Is that the best place to get like the most official updated route?
Yes. Yeah. I try to keep that as updated as possible. And right now believe it or not, there has been no changes to the 300 since October, which is shocking. So I keep waiting to hear,
but from the ATA making changes.
If something happens at the ATA, then it trickles down to me and I update it. But so far, nothing yet. So we should be good to go. And then if I hear something, I'll update it. But I try to do if it's something significant, I try to announce that. Like, hey, heads up, you know, there's a change. Make sure you have version 2 or whatever it is. Because I think by the time the Grand Depart rolled around last year, I think the 800 was on version 10 and the 300 was like version 8 or something. I don't know. It was ridiculous last year. It was just so bizarre. And it was a variety of reasons. You know, there was a bunch of ATA reroutes, some big projects they finished up, Casablanca Canyons being one. The Highline Trail had a bunch of work done. There was a bypass I had to do because of a squatter camp that sprung up. There was the National Park by Tucson reached out to me wanting a special use permit all of a sudden. So I had to go down there and reroute the route around that. And I was like, oh, what the heck? So as far as permits go, and that one in particular, technically you should have a state trust land permit and you can get that. I have a link to it, I believe, on the FAQ page of the race website. Those permits are for the Arizona State Land Trust Department. They're $15 per person, but it's good for a whole year. It just kind of covers your bases and you're doing everything that you should to have one. I was just going to say, because the AZT does go through state trust land, but the AZT has an agreement with the state trust department that they have a like an easement. So you don't need a permit when the AZT goes through state trust land. But when anytime I have to reroute the trail off the AZT, if I have to reroute, you know, through state trust land out of that corridor, that's when you would need a permit. And of course, it was state trust land outside of Saguaro National Park by Tucson, which I was like, really? Because before I made that reroute, we didn't need a permit for the 300. But, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. So I never mind donating to, you know, organizations that are like helping to maintain or protect wild spaces. You know, it's like that's
right.
That's easy for me to kick you some money to help out because we use and recreate on that property. So you know, it makes sense to be an ally and I don't try to cheap out whenever it comes to
trails. I mean, stuff doesn't get built for free. I mean, some people might think that it does and like, yeah, there's volunteers and stuff, but you know what? It's just at the end of the day, it's like, you know, just be a good steward, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Be a good steward of the land, and that's a part of it.
Yep.
Well, cool, man. Any other tips or resources or anything we should share before we close it out and let you go back to your family and enjoy your evening and start? We'll really start packing for the Queen's Ransom.
I know, right? I guess one other comment: if you do make a donation to the ATA, put a comment in there and just say something along the lines like AZTR or slash like a rollover gate. Then that way, that lets them know where the donation is coming from. You know, because sometimes, you know, if they get random money, I mean, that's cool. They're not going to say no to that, but it's nice to let them know that it's the bike packing community that's doing it. Yeah. And just to reinforce that. Cause I'm pretty sure with the Grand Apart last year, we did generate enough for a rollover gate, which is about $1,600. And that's the manufacturing installation and all that stuff for a gate. Now, I need to ask Matt Nelson, the director, if we get to choose where that goes. Because I have a couple that would be really nice to get replaced. So that's, I'm sure he's more like, which is the easiest one to replace?
So. Well, yeah, I love that. I was actually curious if, because I haven't made a donation, but I'm planning to before I ride it. And I was curious if there was like a comment box where I could, you know, say, hey, I'm a bike packer or whatever. And
that way
they know, the cyclists are paying.
When I announced that last year, I was like, well, I should probably get the ball rolling and make one myself. So I did that. And I was like, oh, okay. You just say donate, you put in your money and there's a comment thing right here. And well, all right, it was that easy. So
perfect.
Just like that. Let's see. Well, I think that's probably it. And I think I sent it to you. I did send you a track leaders registration link for spring. So if you wanted to have a dot on the track leaders map, get one up there.
Yeah. Yeah. Anybody who wants like an official ITT time up on track leaders, like, I'll link to all this stuff in the show notes, but then obviously, I assume that link can also be found on your race website.
It will be tonight because I actually looked and I forgot to put it up there. So I haven't, there's an announcement page. So that's where that will be. So yeah, I'll get that up
by
tonight.
By the time this episode comes out, it'll be done. You can check it off your list.
Yeah. And then I can start packing.
Yeah.
So,
well, John, I really appreciate you. I appreciate you coming on to chat. We've been talking about doing this episode for a while. And also, man, I appreciate all your work on the EZT. Like there's, you know, the internet is full of chatter and I always hear really good things about you and about how much hard work you put into the Arizona Trail. And really shows, man. So we need people like you out there who are also good stewards of like these routes and helping to maintain them and provide access for people like me coming out of state. Like, I just want to show up and ride. I don't,
I know, right?
and this makes it easier. So I really appreciate you coming on and also all the work you do on the trail, man. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate that. And yeah, when you guys are out there, I'm actually the passage steward for the Ripsy segment and like the corridor steward for Oracle to Kelvin, which covers like the Black Hills and Ripsy, which is the Tortilla Mountains. So, and I haven't been out there in a while, which I need to get out there and go check on my segment. So if you happen to see like extra cat claw, sorry about that. Maybe let me know and I'll get out there and trim it. So yeah.
Yeah. I'll just send you a picture of all the cat claws stuck everywhere. I'll be like, hey buddy.
Arm covering and leg covering is encouraged. So yeah. Sun sleeves and you know, it's, it helps for just, you know, the sun too, and cat claw. So it's, we do our best to clear as much as we can, but as you know, it's 800 miles. You can only do so much. Right. And we're not out there in July trimming anything in the desert. So
yeah, it is what it is, man. I've heard that cat claw likes to, grow into the vacant spaces. And I guess a lot of plants do. It's like, if they're not competing for anything where the trail is. So it just kind of grows into the trail.
It's just evil. It's just evil stuff, man. God. So good luck with that. So
thanks. I know I'm going to be, my daughter just came home from her tennis practice, but I know I'm going to be cursing it. I'll try not to curse your name though. I'll only say nice things about you when I'm out there.
Got it.
You're like, yeah, right.
Yeah. All right. Sounds good, man.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you again.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode. And thanks again to John Schilling for coming on and sharing his wisdom about all things Arizona Trail. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider signing up to support Bikes or Death over at patreon.com/bikesordeath and to take advantage of the new patron-only Come Ride With Me series featuring me as I take you along some of my rides and record thoughts as I prepare and take on some of my own personal cycling and bikepacking trips. And of course, don't forget to check out Campfire Cycling at campfirecycling.com for all of your AZT preparation needs. All right, well, that's all we have for you today. Thank you so much for being here. Until next time, you know what to do. Go ride your damn bike.
It was the middle of the night. You grabbed your knife and you held it tight. The sounds of beasts kept you awake. The sounds they made kept you afraid. In the morning, you packed your bike. Memories forgotten from the previous night. You rode faster than ever before. Was it your imagination or merely folklore? Fear turned into strength as you pushed further. Every pedal stroke, stronger and firmer. Your bike feels weightless, your legs aren't tired. You think to yourself, just a few more miles. Bikes or death. Bikes or death.